Dublin, writes John Banville, is an incomprehensibly graphomane capital, less city than town, less town than village, less village than inkpot. Dublin, a writer city, investigates the extent to which the capital has not only been reflected by, but created by its authors, poets and dramatists. This author, Chris Morrish, is the inaugural Seamusini Professor of Irish Writing. He's with me in studio this evening. And yes, even when he writes a short sentence, John Banville has to send us off to the dictionary to find out what what a graphomane is.
Yeah.
But he's kind of capturing in that sentence, you know, Dublin almost was created out of an inkpot. It is as much a creation by a set of writers as it was the melting pot that brought a set of writers together. That's basically what your book's about, Chris.
Yeah, it is. I mean, I came to Dublin in the 1980s, and I suppose the gap between what Dublin looked like and the kind of allure of the place, the magic of the place.
The Dublin that you had read about.
Yeah, the Dublin I'd read about was particularly at that point, was quite remarkable. You know, I mean, I lived on Westland Row, and you looked at Westland Row, and it was a fairly innocuous-looking street.
Yeah, but let's actually, what's extraordinary is, you gave that Westland Row address to the cab driver when you arrived here in 1985. And as you were giving him that Westland Row address, it suddenly struck you all of the connections that you had from your reading to that address.
I mean, I was going to 15 Westland Row. I realised that Oscar Wilde had been born six doors down at 21, that if I went to one end of the street, which I did more or less as soon as I arrived, looking for a chemist shop, there's Sweeney's Chemist Shop, which is where Leopold Bloom buys lemon soap from Molly Bloom. It's kitty corner to Finn's Hotel, where, of course, Joyce goes on his first walkabout with Nora Barnacle. Around the corner is the office where Samuel Beckett worked in his father's office on Clare Street. Go to the other end of the street, look diagonally across Pierce Street. There is what was the ancient concert rooms, which is where the first production of the Irish Literary Theatre took place in 1899. It becomes the Abbey. All this was within the first few minutes. Mm. And it was almost like there was another city that was invisible if you didn't know the literature, that was sitting on top of the real city.
Yeah, and that's what you do. You start mapping out in the book, you map out this unseen city. But if you can't see the place, it's hard to make a map.
Yes, it is. And I suppose that's what the book tries to do. That once you know the story, you never walk by a place again and not see what's there. I mean, last night, Roddy Doyle was launching the book and he was saying how he has a place where he works on Dame Street, and he goes to a little diner up on Lord Edward Street, Rosie's. And he said, I hadn't realized the first theatre in Dublin was right there opposite St. Werburgh's Church in the 1630s. And he said, I will never again go into the diner without knowing that there was a theatre here on this site. And once you know it, the city becomes a different place.
And that idea, I mean, you quote Elizabeth Bowen in the book as well about the idea that she talks about emotional memory here has so much power that the past and the present seem to be lived simultaneously. Mm-hmm. In some ways, I think what you're saying is the actual and the fictional, because most of these creations that you're talking about are totally fictional. The actual and the fictional are living side by side.
I think that's right. And I think that's one of the things that makes Dublin so special, is that sense that the past and the present co-inhabit the same space. And I mean, Elizabeth Bowen, she's just so good at capturing things absolutely precisely. And I think one of the reasons for that, when she was writing that in the 1940s, was that Dublin as a city had, you know, a century and a half of underdevelopment at that point. So where other cities, you know, tear down, build up, tear down, build up, in Dublin, the tearing down didn't happen to the same extent. So the Georgian city was there. The Victorian city was there. There were traces of the medieval city were still there. The modern city was there. So all the bits of the city kind of sat side by side. So you could see the physical traces of the city, and therefore the memories kind of, you know, have something to hang on to.
And the writers, in many ways, across the generations, they're like, you know, if you visit any city in Italy, you're going to be shown, you'll go inside a building and you'll see right down the layers of the building underneath from different periods in time, different architectural periods. In terms of writers here, you get the same thing. One writer almost mapped on top of another in a different chronological period.
And that's what I wanted to do with the book. I didn't want to write a history that just, you know, started at the year, some beginning point and went up to the present. I wanted to do a book that was organized spatially, so that if you took a street and you say you took a street, say, somewhere in the Liberties, and you have Jonathan Swift there in the 18th century, you have James Clarence Mangan in those same streets in the 19th century, or the great Gothic writer Charles Maturin there in the 19th century. And then you layer on top of that, say, a Tana French crime novel set there in the 21st century. And it's like all those things exist side by side. So I almost imagine sort of the characters and the authors talking to one another, co-inhabiting the streets.
Yeah, because to think that you could have Tana French and Jonathan Swift sitting right beside each other it's quite an exciting prospect.
It is. Yeah, it is. Yeah.
Now, if the minute we talk about maps of Dublin and writers creating a city, the first person that's going to come to mind is Joyce. You can't walk the streets of Dublin without thinking of Joyce, of course, because that's what he made Leopold Bloom do in Ulysses. He made him walk the streets of Dublin. Explain the term Bagatonia to me.
Yeah, it's a sort of piece of imaginary geography. Mm. It generally refers to that sort of area around Baggot Street Bridge, Parsons Bookshop, Searson's Pub, that area in around there, because so many writers lived there in the 1940s and 50s. I mean, John Banville is quite witty on this as to what constitutes Bagatonia and what doesn't. Mm-hmm. That, you know, Percy Place, at one end of it, the leafy end is Bagatonia, and the other end is Bagatonia, but the middle is definitely not. It's just, you know, such are the mysterious ways of cities. But it was an area in which a tremendous number of writers lived. Patrick Kavanagh, most famously, lived in, you know, Pembroke Road, he lived in Wilton Place, he lived in Raglan Road. Brendan Behan lived in Herbert Street. John Montague lived just down from him. Dolman Press was around the corner. The Pike Theatre was there. The Lantern Theatre was there. And then, of course, you had O'Donoghue's Pub, and the Dubliners are starting up by the time you get to the 60s. So you had this quite small little nest of streets, and you could walk around that area today on a Sunday morning and hardly see a soul. Mm. That was just rich in literary culture and people living there.
You mentioned the Kavanagh, and obviously we immediately think of the canals when it comes to Kavanagh as well. But I have a clip here of Kavanagh himself, because it brings up, I think, another idea that you express quite strongly in the book regarding the Colchies and the Jack Eanes. Not terms that you use, they're my terms. Let's have a listen to Paddy Kavanagh.
If ever you go to Dublin town in 100 years or so, inquire for me in Baggot Street and what he was like to know. Oh, he was a queer one, fal dal the dido. He was a queer one, I tell you. My great-grandmother knew him well. He asked her to come and call on him in his flat, and she giggled at the thought of a young girl's lovely fall. Oh, he was dangerous, fal dal the dido. He was dangerous, I tell you. On Pembroke Road, look out for my ghost, dishevelled with shoes untied, playing through the railings with little children, whose children have long since died. Oh, he was a nice man, fal dal the dido. He was a nice man, I tell you. Go into a pub and listen well, if my voice still echoes there. Ask the men what their grandfathers thought, and to tell them to answer fair. Oh, he was eccentric, fal dal the dido. He was eccentric, I tell you.
That's Paddy Kavanagh, and if ever you go to Dublin town, from the RTE archives. That's an extraordinary little bit of singing from Kavanagh there, isn't it, Chris Morrish?
Yeah, it is an extraordinary piece of meaning. And Kavanagh's part of that generation that when we think of a literary Dublin, this is what we think of, I think. There's a lot, is that world of McDade's Pub, people, Kavanagh, Brendan Behan, Flann O'Brien, there's others around that area. And it was a real literary scene, but it was a destructive one as well. You know, that it was one that was really centered around drink. It was centered around a lot of personal animosities. They're all writers who produce great work. But there's also a real struggle there as well, and I think a real sadness about it. And some of it is about being displaced, I think.
Yeah, because I think you give us this idea of, you know, this, there's always a duality when it comes to Dublin in many ways. The you know, that kind of wonderful place that nurtured all these writers, but yet had a destructive capacity within it as well. Yeah. A city, as you put it, that is full of country people. And of course, Paddy Kavanagh fits into that perfectly.
Absolutely. And his best work comes when he is able to reconcile those two things. When he starts to write those sonnets about the Grand Canal, the Grand Canal Bank, and he takes a perfectly ordinary piece of the city, just a canal lock, and he invests it with all the beauty and all the peace and all the calm of the pastoral. So in the center of the city, it's like he finds this little perfect place. And then in the middle of it, you know, all around that, you have Paddy Kavanagh, you know, producing chaos in the kind of the song you hear there, where he's prodding everybody in sight and, having a go. Yeah.
But the world that is described in that and the world that you've described in many ways, McDade's pub and all the rest, that's a quite male-centric type of world. But you're very, and from the outset, you are very keen and very clear to have a lot of female writers in here as well. Was there a kind of a parallel map, if you like, that wasn't as gender stuck as the male map?
Absolutely. I mean, this is one of the things that was fascinating as I start kind of unraveling this world, is we all know about that world in the 40s and the 50s around McDade's, and it was very, very male, you know, very testosterone driven. And then in the same streets, you had writers like Mary Lavin lived in Ladd Lane. You had Teresa Devey lived in Waterloo Road. You had Kate O'Brien would have, you know, been around the city. Elizabeth Bowen is, you know, the only writer actually born in Bagotonia at that time, really. Yeah. She was born in Herbert Place, you know, right on the canal. So you had a whole group of women, and they formed a society called the Irish Women's Writers Club. And they had monthly meetings, and they would meet in places like the Gresham or the Country House, Country Shop Restaurant, or the Shelburne, and they would have a dinner. And they were actually even able to act in political ways, in a kind of concerted way. There was an episode in which a postmistress had been dismissed in Wicklow, and they collectively acted and lobbied on her behalf. So all this was happening at the same time, in the same streets, but almost in a kind of parallel way.
Yeah, so it's like there are different maps
for
where you want to go in terms of the literature itself.
Yeah, even at the same time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And there are certain places that you've mentioned, the Liberties and Jonathan Dean Swift, and bring us right up to Tana French. What about the North Inner City? And of course, we're going to immediately think of Sean O'Casey. But Dorset Street is very, or Dorset Street, depending on your preference, is very interesting in this case.
Yeah, I mean, there must be something in the water in Dorset Street, because it's. I can't think of too many streets in the world that have produced a major playwright in three different centuries. So, you know, Richard Brinsley Sheridan, you know, was born there. His father, Thomas Sheridan, lived on the street when he was the manager of Smock Alley in the 18th century. Dion Boucicault, probably one of the most successful playwrights in the world in the 19th century, was born right up along there as well, not too far down. And then, of course, Sean O'Casey is born exactly into that same area in the 20th century. So in three different centuries, you get three major playwrights all born within a few minutes walk of each other.
You also find a map that can link us almost, you almost take us on a walk that links us Joyce into Beckett and across over the sea, over the bay to Seamus Heaney.
Yeah, I mean, again, I mean, you know, Heaney lived for many years happily in Strand Road. Where he lived was not actually very far from where Yeats was born. Mm. We tend to think of Yeats with Sligo and all over the place, but he was actually born there in South Dublin. You could down the coast a bit and you're at the Martello Tower where Joyce famously sets the opening of Ulysses and lived briefly. And then from there, you're looking across to Dunleary Pier. End of Dunleary Pier is the anemometer that Beckett uses in Crap's Last Tape, and which forms one of the key moments in his work. I mean, how many places in the world do you have three Nobel laureates and one who should have been all lined up
all
like
lined
that?
Up in that fashion. And I suppose we have a Seamus Heaney poem from the famous collected poems, the Lannan Foundation collected poems that are so beloved of people. This links in with what you're saying there, the poem In Illo Tempore. Just give us a lead into this, if you would, Chris.
Yeah, this is Heaney looking out on the Strand, looking out on Sandymount Strand. And what he is channeling here is the opening of the Proteus episode of Ulysses. where Stephen Dedalus looks out across Sandymouth Strand, and anybody knows that when the tide goes out, this is exactly what you feel. And he says, am I walking into eternity on Sandymouth Strand? And Heaney picks up that idea. The title in Latin basically means in that time, but it usually refers to the time before history.
The big missile splayed and dangled silky ribbons of emerald and purple and watery white. Intransitively, we would assist, confess, receive. The verbs assumed us. We adored. And we lifted our eyes to the nouns. Altar stone was dawn and monstrance noon. The word rubric itself a bloodshot sunset. Now I live by a famous strand where seabirds cry in the small hours like incredible souls. And even the range wall of the promenade that I pressed down on for conviction hardly tempts me to credit it.
That's Seamus Heaney and In Illo Tempore there. That's from Station Island, is the collection that's from, isn't it?
That is from Station Island, yeah. And there's another part of Station Island where Joyce imagines he's walking by the seawall on Sandymouth Strand, and Joyce is down there on the strand, and he kind of helps him up off the strand.
Heaney imagining that he's meeting Joyce there. You also use Joyce as a way, because you do look to the past in some ways, and you build these layers of writer upon writer, which keeps bringing me back to this idea of the foundations of a building and the different layers of architecture. There's a touch of that in there, but you find a way of looking forward, and you use Joyce to do that.
Yeah. I think Joyce provides us with a way of not just imagining the city, but imagining the way in which writers talk to one another. And I think this is a good example of that. One of the mysteries is, you know, how does Dublin keep producing so many good writers? And I think once you have a kind of critical mass of writers, writers begin to kind of play off one another. So, you know, here's Heaney knowing that he is living opposite the strand that Joyce has written about. And so that becomes something that Heaney writes about. And, you know, and you can see that kind of moving forward into the future as well, of writers continually playing off one another.
And Gabriel, I suppose, in The Dead, he kind of he looks into a new version. Is it, he's looking westward here?
He is, yeah. I mean, at the end of The Dead, there's that marvelous passage where Gabriel's looking across the west, or to the west of Ireland, you know, and snow is general over Ireland. And one of the things I asked myself was, good, why does Joyce set that episode in Usher's Island? You know, why there? And realized at the time he was writing that story, he was also giving lectures in Trieste about James Clarence Mangan. And he uses a phrase in the essay about Mangan that is very much like what he says in The Dead, where he says, no moment of exaltation is ever lost, this sense that it goes on and on. And Mangan was born about 100 yards away from Usher's Island.
From Usher's Island. Let's have a listen to, again, from the RTE Archives, famous rendition here of The Dead of James Joyce.
A few light taps upon the pane, hills falling softly general all over Ireland on his journey westward. Silver and dark pane, native din, was dissolving and dwindling. A few light taps upon the pane made him turn to the window. It had begun to snow again. He watched sleepily the flakes, silver and dark, falling obliquely against the lamplight. The time had come for him to set out on his journey westward. Yes, the newspapers were right. Snow was general all over Ireland. It was falling on every part of the dark central plain, on the treeless hills, falling softly upon the Bog of Allen, and farther westward, softly falling into the dark, mutinous Shannon waves. It was falling, too, upon every part of the lonely churchyard on the hill where Michael Fury lay buried. It lay thickly drifted on the crooked crosses and headstones, on the spears of the little gate, on the barren thorns. His soul swooned slowly as he heard the snow falling faintly through the universe, and faintly falling, like the descent of their last end, upon all the living and the dead.
Wonderful closing moments there. It's quite extraordinary, Chris Morris. I mean, it's even just to let that wash over you for no other reason than to listen to it. Perfectly acceptable. Now, we've been talking about your book, Dublin, A Writer's City, but this is a part of a series from Cambridge University Press, Imagining Cities.
That's right, yeah. I mean, this was the first one, and Cambridge University Press liked it so much they decided to do more. So the second book in the series, with kind of wonderful inattention to order, was launched last week, actually, New Orleans. Which is a fabulous book, and we have books commissioned on New York, London, and Cambridge itself.
Right,
and kind of more in the pipeline.
More in the pipeline for sure. Well, congratulations on the book. I know you had a lot of fun doing it. You were telling me, Chris, you'll be back in with us next week.
I will. Yes, Dublin Literary Award shortlist coming out next week.
Time of the year again.
Second
year every 2 years.
And we have six great books coming up.
Well, we'll find out more about that next week. But thanks. In the meantime, for being in with us today or tonight. Dublin, A Writer's City by Chris Morris, published by Cambridge University Press. It was launched last night, wasn't it? Yeah, it was launched, and that launched by Roddy Doyle. Okay, now, as if to prove it's almost illegal now, I think, to hold an international award show without a more than decent showing from Ireland, the nominations for the television BAFTAs were announced today, and once again, we are covered in glory. Bad Sisters, Sharon Horgan's hit for Apple, is nominated for Best Drama Series, Best Supporting Actress for Anne-Marie Duff, Best Director for Dervla Walsh, and the show also appears in the categories for Best Scripted Casting and Best Titles and Graphic Identity. Elsewhere, Fiona Shaw is up for Best Supporting Actress for her performance as Marva Andor in Andor, opposite Diego Luna as her son.
Who else knows?
About what?
That you were born in Canary.
You don't want to hear what happened?
We'll get to that, but who knows? Who have we told?
I don't know,
We have always said Fest. Every doc I've ever submitted has always said you were born on Fest. Have you ever said anything other than Fest?
Officially, no. I don't think so. But people, yes.
Who?
And so do you.
Well, how many?
I don't know. It's not something I've been keeping track of.
Well, everyone I've told is dead.
That's ridiculous. Jesse. Samo. Huh?
That's family.
If we're making a list, we're making a list.
Well, it's all your women I'm worried about.
Oh, come on, please.
Femi, Carla,
stop,
Sondri.
Stop!
There's something they don't even know.
Baba Bix.
Bix has nothing to do with
this. Well, then who told these primo bastards about Canary?
That's Fiona Shaw, BAFTA nominated in the TV BAFTA nominations today for her as Best Supporting Actress for her performance in Marva Andor, or in Andor as Marva Andor. Siobhan McSweeney gets the nod as well for her work as Sister Michael. This is in the final series of Derry Girls. Here she is, showing them one of her many skills. This time it's torturing girls on exam results day.
Should we say a wee prayer first, maybe?
Yeah, I'd say our Lord is up there now, looking down on the world, thinking the floods and the famine can wait. For there is a child in Derry who needs me to magically alter the contents of an envelope.
Well, that's very good, Sister Michael. It's very funny.
You said we failed.
I didn't say you failed. I implied you failed.
Why?
Bit of a slow day.
Siobhan McSweeney as Sister Michael in Derry Girls. Scripted, also Derry Girls appears in several other nominations in today's TV BAFTAs. Scripted comedy category, it's in there as well. That's not all. Lisa McGee was nominated in the writer comedy category for Derry Girls, as is Nancy Harris for her work on The Dry, and Sharon Horgan for Motherland. Another series, which came to an end recently, of course, is Peaky Blinders. Cillian Murphy receives his first BAFTA nomination for his performance as Thomas Shelby. And the evergreen Graham Norton Show is up for Best Comedy Entertainment Show. Now, I think that outnumbers the 14 Oscar nominations that we had. I've lost count, but I think I have everyone included in there. The awards take place in London's Royal Festival Hall on Sunday, the 14th of May. And here then, from the opening sequence of the striking and now BAFTA nominated Bad Sisters, here's PJ Harvey with her version of Leonard Cohen's Who by the Fire.
Who in mortal chains, who in power, and who shall I say is calling?
DJ Harvey there, and her version of Who by the Fire from the title sequence of Bad Sisters, the Bad Sisters, the multi-BAFTA nominated Bad Sisters. Well, there's certainly a busy spring and summer ahead for the Irish Baroque Orchestra. They once again embrace the music of Johann Sebastian Bach, Frederick Handel, George Frederick Handel, and more of the great composers from the Baroque period. Artistic director Peter Whelan is with me in studio this evening. And whatever about the summer, Peter, I suppose the next few days, this is where your immediate focus is for, with beyond doubt, I would have thought. The Irish Baroque Orchestra will perform St. Matthew Passion, the Bach Passion in Kilkenny tomorrow, in Dublin on Friday, in Galway on Saturday. Obviously, we're talking about a staple of the Easter calendar here and the Easter liturgical calendar, specifically in the case of the Matthew Passion of Johann Sebastian Bach. What did he do with this particular liturgical text that makes it so special?
It's an extraordinary piece. I've been rehearsing it now for 3 days in a row. We start our concerts tomorrow, but it's just a universe. It's just a huge piece on its own. Maybe a lot of people refer to it as the greatest classical music work. Mm. And of course, it's about the Passion. Of course, it's Johann Sebastian Bach, but maybe it's his greatest work. And it's vast. And it's, as I said, it's his own universe. It's got everything in it. Like you could never explore it to the extent, to the edge of the universe, basically. But yeah, so it's such a huge piece. It's so hard to talk about it because it is basically everything.
Yeah. So what we have here, is it the biblical text from Matthew? What part of the Passion is being told in the Bach version? And is it just the biblical text, or I think he brings in some other texts?
That's
as well,
right. There's we're talking about the biblical part is where from where Jesus is arrested, the Last Supper, and the Matthew Passion stretches all the way up to where the tomb is sealed, because it was always for Good Friday, and then on Easter, then you can celebrate the resurrection. That was the basic plan. That Bach had, and yeah, there was a guy called Picander who's also writing kind of more poetic kind of interjections that he put into the text as well throughout. It's just vast. Of course, the central part of it is these chorales that you hear, which are like jazz standards for the Protestant Church, basically Lutheran Church. They existed from Martin Luther himself wrote some of them, and they're an integral part. And yeah, if you dig into the piece, you find that they're everywhere. And Bach, his genius, is expanding on them in all kinds of amazing ways.
How does we're going to listen to the opening section first of all? Just explain to us how, because he lays out his stable here, really, doesn't he, in this opening part?
Absolutely. Bach. I mean, it's vast. The very first movement is just huge. E minor from the very beginning, it feels like it's coming from deep within the earth. You know, the lowest strings of the instruments. Amazing thing is that there's two whole orchestras in this answering each other, two sets of soloists answering each other. So it's as big a structure as existed in the Baroque era. And then in the middle of all of this, these two choirs answering each other, one choir talking about the daughters of Zion and crying for them, and then one chorus asking why they're upset. And then in the middle of it all, there's a cantus firmus, so this really ancient melody that goes right the way through it, but you'd hardly notice it unless you really could study this.
Yeah, you have to look at it very carefully. Now, we won't get the whole 6 minutes and 53 seconds in, but we will get a sense even from the opening minute or so of it, just how big a canvas Bach is using when he's painting here.
Just
I just let about 2 minutes of it go there to give us a sense of it. The opening section of the St. Matthew Passion of Johann Sebastian Bach, which will be performed by the Irish Baroque Orchestra in various venues over the coming nights, and artistic director of IBO, Peter Whelan, is with me in studio this evening. So I was saying as we were listening to that, so two orchestras, Peter, you have said, two sets of soloists, two choruses, two choirs, effectively. What kind of numbers are we talking about?
Well, it's basically it's kind of a 18th century version of a stereo system, and like Thomas Kirke, where Bach worked, there were two separate organ lofts across from each other, answering each other. It's a good question how many people are involved. There's a lot of theories, and we're going back to one of the very first theories about it, that there should only be one singer on each part.
Yeah, so you have one soprano, one alto, one tenor, one bass.
Exactly, that's
it. But you have two sets of those.
Two sets of those across from each other. They're singing all of the choruses, all of the chorales, all of the solos. So it's huge for them. Of course, when the piece was like rediscovered in the 1820s by Mendelssohn, he had absolutely vast forces working. And then the Victorian era became a very popular piece too, but just giant. So we're kind of pairing it back. It's now... in its simplest, clean line version, that's what we're trying to achieve with these particular performances. Yeah.
And again, as we think of the idea of, excuse me, we think of the idea of site-specific performance as something very modern. But in fact, when Bach wrote this for the particular church he was in, he was making use of these two organ lofts, and the spacing of the various musicians was very important. One choir and one set of solos in one place, etc. Do you do something similar in the various venues that you go to this time?
That's right. Well, the two orchestras are placed across from each other. So I think for the audience, it'll just be an amazing wash of sound. And you have the questioning groups coming from one side, the various soloists, the various characters coming from different positions inside of the cathedrals that we're playing. I don't think any church in Ireland has got the luxury of two organ lofts on opposite side, but yeah, we'll do our best to kind of recreate.
That kind of sense within it. I was saying to you too, one of the questions that constantly comes up in my mind around oratorio in particular, because oratorio is a type of prayer. It's usually a sacred or a liturgical text, but for us now in the 21st century, it's pretty much a secular activity, a secular entertainment. How do you go about? Is there a balance to be struck there for when you're performing it?
That's an interesting point. Of course, we're performing it in ecclesiastical venues, but as you say, in a lot of respects, it's a secular or a meditative event. I suppose a lot of people enjoy those spaces and come for different reasons, and because the music is as good as it gets, whether you're atheist or religious, or it's still a great work of art that we're dealing with this piece.
And your soloists here are a vocal group called Sestina.
That's right. They're based, in Belfast. Mark Chambers runs them. We've done a lot of work with them. They use a mixture of mostly young professionals and people coming into the industry. It's just a wonderful level of solos, and it's as well they're young and have a really good breath control, because this is a huge thing for all of them. Like, they're all soloists in their own right, and it's like over 3 hours of singing, three nights in a row. So they're like marathon runners, basically.
Yeah, and again, it's really important to just emphasize that fact, because we hear two choruses, but two sets of soloists, but we are talking two sets of four people. We're only talking eight people doing the singing here, which is a phenomenal amount of work for each singer.
Yes, they believe that that's what happened in the 18th century, that it was just one per part. Like, looking as well at we have a lot of information about how Bach operated and put together his cantatas, and they hardly had any time to put things together. I think they're just thrown the music, the parts, with the ink wet on the page. It was just we know this piece really well. I think it was Bach only heard it and performed it maybe four times in his lifetime. We'll have done it much more than that, and it's just amazing how quickly they put it together. Maybe it was very ramshackle performance. Like, we know that Bach complained about the level of his choir. We know that there would have been dogs running around the church, people talking. Like nowadays, people get bored during services or masses, and people could be wandering around the church during this. This piece, as I said, is over 3 hours long, but it was supposed to just sandwich a sermon as well. So it was a really long Good Friday for the congregation, basically. Yeah,
I'm going to skip through past one of the chorales to "Soest mein Jesus nun gefangen." This is the point at which, in the Passion story, Jesus has been captured effectively.
Exactly.
Again, you might explain the form here, because he uses all sorts of combinations and variations, Bach, in how he puts the piece together.
This is this particular piece just pairs it back to the atoms of the work. It starts so simply with just these two small notes in the strings that are kind of obsessively repeated, and a beautiful woodwind melody over the top, and then soprano and alto just kind of a lament, just very long lines painted about him being captured, and then this interjection from the other choir, who are in a completely different sound world. Just saying, capture him, basically.
And it really is. You know, you get a real sense of how Bach was looking for the drama here, Peter Whelan, you know, with the small instrumentation, the two solo voices, and then the chorus shouting from the other side. He liked the operatic style of that.
Absolutely. So Bach never wrote an opera, but all of his religious music is using those operatic devices all of the time. So he actually was a really dramatic composer. I think as well that the way they presented religious music at the time was much more visceral. That they weren't holding back from the emotions. I think nowadays we're a little bit distant from the texts. They're just kind of said by rote. But back then you could really mean it.
Yeah.
And that's what we get with all of these single singers on each part. Just a lot more of a human immediate emotional connection.
I suppose there are a couple of things you just clarify. Who? What voice plays what role? Because you might. I often think, well, who's the tenor going to be here? Is Jesus going to get the tenor role,
yeah,
or who's going to get the tenor role, or what voice is going to be used for Jesus, which you would presume is the main part? Crass about it.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So we have a storyteller called the evangelist, who's a tenor, and sings throughout and kind of sets the scene, and Jesus is sung by a bass. And every time Jesus speaks, he's surrounded. Bach gives him a halo of strings. So we know it's Jesus because it's a low voice. And then suddenly this really beautifully coloured text. Whereas when the evangelist sings, it's a dry recitative, which is just like the harpsichord and the organ. So you could really get the contrast between the two.
Yeah, so the storyteller gets just a little bit of a come, but when it's Jesus, he gets the whole shooting.
He's the main guy, yeah.
Yep. When I'll finish up with what I reckon is probably the best known section. If you hear a standalone piece from the St. Matthew Passion, it's probably going to be a Berma Dich. Explain to us what's going on here as we head into it.
Yeah, this is such a touching aria. Basically, Peter has denied Jesus three times, and he's just feeling just awful. He's feeling so guilty, and this is he's him asking for begging for forgiveness.
Guilt of Peter, expressed so well by Johann Sebastian Bach in Erbarme Dich there from the St. Matthew Passion. And all of the sections that we heard there from the John Eliot Gardner recording with the English Baroque soloists. But Peter Whelan and the Irish Baroque Orchestra will perform Bach's St. Matthew Passion tomorrow, Thursday. That's in St. Canice's Cathedral in Kilkenny. They're in St. Patrick's Cathedral in Dublin on Friday, and finally in Galway Cathedral on Saturday. And you can find out full details on IrishBaroqueOrchestra.com. Great Expectations, the Charles Dickens classic, is the new Sunday night drama on BBC TV. Stephen Knight of Peaky Blinders fame has adapted it into 6 episodes. No small amount of controversy here. The orphaned ambitious Pip is heard to use the F word on occasion. Strong ensemble cast headed by Olivia Colman as Miss Havisham, And our own Owen McDonald plays Joe, the decent blacksmith and Pip's brother-in-law. Mary McGill has watched the first two episodes of the series and she joins me now. I suppose, Mary, the first... We've had a lot of Great Expectations and BBC adaptations of the same. Is this one doing something extraordinarily different?
I have to say, Sean, right off the bat, full disclosure, not really. And I mean, to put it in context for the audience, we're talking about 17 screen adaptations, not just by the BBC, but I mean, Great Expectations is a text that filmmakers and television producers on both sides of the Atlantic keep returning to. We've had 11 stage adaptations of it. So this is a much loved work. It's a work that people love to translate and interpret and do all kinds of things with. So to try and do something new with it is undoubtedly challenging. What we do get with Stephen Knight is that kind of, I would say, Peaky Blinders streak or effect. So we get more violence, we get more sex, some of it quite risque. We get swearing. We even get drug taking, Sean, right? Miss Havisham is smoking opium at one point. I couldn't help thinking to myself, what would Dickens make of all of this? But all of which is to say, if we're talking about breaking new ground, not necessarily. And I think that's one of the things I found myself wondering, because this new adaptation does put a great emphasis on diversity. It takes a critical look at the empire, which is all to the good. But I did find myself wondering if we actually need more diversity in terms of the text, that you know, the classic texts that get interpreted. Maybe that needs to be expanded now as well. We need to be looking for other stories, so to speak.
I mean, it is a great story. Magwitch, the escaped convict, Estella, the cruel beauty, Miss Havisham, the jilted aging bride, Pip, the young dreamer, and how he falls into a fortune because of his lovely act of kindness to Magwitch early on in the episode. Now, I've only seen the first episode here. I suppose the first thing that struck me was, you know, I even in terms of the visuals here, we're in the murky, horrible, marshy land of the opening sequence. I saw nothing here, apart from the diversity in some of the casting that and the use of the F word. That kind of was all that brought it into a kind of a modern day scenario for me.
Yes, and it is, I will say, it is beautiful to look at, Sean, and all the iconic elements that we associate with Great Expectations are there. So we get, you know, yes, the effect of the marsh, the spookiness. I think it is such a ghostly story in many respects. You know, Miss Havisham, Olivia Colman, really, you know, working her magic with it, but this haunting effect, and of course the marshes themselves and Magwitch, this terrifying character, young Pip, this innocent, ambitious boy. So all those elements are there, and they are, you know, we get these modern inflections, but we still get that sense, you know, that great scene on the marshes when Magwitch encounters Pip, scares the bejesus out of him and us in that same moment, right? So we and what we know, because we're also familiar with that story, is that for Pip, his life is changing in so many ways all at once, but this is a key encounter with Magwitch on the moors or on the marshes.
Very important, but I guess if we have had several versions of Great Expectations, can the BBC, can British drama do anything that doesn't have Olivia Colman in it? She's brilliant casting for Miss Havisham, I think it's fair enough to say. But let's have a listen to her in action here with the young Estella, played by Shalom Bruna Franklin, and the young Pip, played by Tom Sweep. Here she is bringing them together. And this, I found, I only saw the first episode, and this is the creepiest moment in the first episode in some ways for me.
Call Estella.
Estella.
Welcome to Eternal Winter.
Innocent moments before the great corruption.
Estella, what do you think of him?
I think he is a common labouring boy with big boots who smells like a stable.
Boy, what do you think of her?
I think she is very proud.
And pretty?
Yes.
So a common boy and a proud, pretty girl. I want to watch you play.
That's Olivia Colman as Miss Havisham. There's something in the way she says, "I want to watch you play," there that kind of has a really dark and sinister undertone to it. This is the new BBC adaptation. You've seen two episodes, Mary. Does it go further down that kind of dark route?
It does, and I have to say, I mean, Olivia Colman excels in everything that she does, but she's particularly good at difficult female characters in period roles. Mm. And this, I mean, is a classic one. What she brings to it, I mean, Miss Havisham is by definition a tragic character, a woman who's been jilted at the altar many years before, still lives in this wedding dress in this squalid mansion. You know, she has become a kind of archetype in literature. But Colman plays it, Sean, with an almost sleazy edge. And I have to say, I completely agree with you. It makes your skin crawl. There's something about her and the way that she encourages this relationship between the children that is deeply, deeply uncomfortable, yeah. But you also can't look away. And I think, you know, she smiles and she has a mouthful of absolutely rotting teeth. And those teeth seem to speak as much to her opium addiction as they do to her soul. Yeah. So, yes, I mean, look, could Olivia Colman do any wrong? Probably not.
Yeah, well, I was gonna
but
say,
it is.
There's a reason she's in everything because she's brilliant indeed. In everything she does. What about the surrounding cast? We heard Tom Sweet there, but in fact, it's Fionn Whitehead who becomes the older Pip, isn't it? And our own MacDonald playing. I thought he did a great job as Joe the Blacksmith in the episode that I saw, that first episode. What are the standout performances for you outside of Olivia Colman from what you've seen so far?
I have to say Hayley Squires, who people may know from I Am Daniel Blake. She was absolutely phenomenal in that. She plays Sarah in this, who is Pip's sister who has taken him in.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yes, she's absolutely wickedly acerbic, Sean. She is not happy that she's had to take in this younger brother, and she is definitely not impressed by his notions of being a gentleman or being anything else. And she's just so brutal and earthy and vengeful and quite violent as well, but she's utterly captivating on screen. I absolutely love Hayley Squires in this.
I thought she certainly brought something to that role. It's often quite a soppy role, not from Hayley Squires.
No, no, indeed. And I really enjoyed, and someone else I always enjoy on screen as well, people who are fans of Toast of London will know Matt Berry very well. He plays Mr. Pumblechook, who is the kind of conduit between Pip, his sister Sarah, and Miss Havisham. And of course, he's another kind of bumbling, wealthy, kind of idiot in a way. And Matt Berry does a great job.
Briefly and finally, there are lots of complaints about the language in it already to the BBC. Are those complaints merited?
Slightly, but I would say if you're looking for a great spin on Great Expectations, I was reminded instantly of David Lean's 1946 adaptation. So look at, if the new fangled edition doesn't suit you, go back and watch the classic. It's well worth your time.
Will you watch the other four episodes as they come out on BBC One over the next few weeks?
I think I'd rather go back to 1946, Sean. It didn't hold me. It didn't grab me in the same way. Sometimes the classics are the best.
Sometimes the 1946 ones are the better ones. Certainly in this case for you, Mary. That's Mary McGill speaking to us about Great Expectations. Starts this Sunday. Is this Sunday, March the 26th? It is, yes. 9 p.m. on BBC One.